So it was coming to a pressure point here in August. And I think that pressure, economically, whatever you want to call, politically, whatever, it forces people to take action at that time. So it's not predicting what, Trump will change his mind on this day or something. It's something that causes him to do so, is the way I look at it. Now, looking at the computer, we're going into World War III for next year.
Hey, everybody. I normally don't give an intro, but this one needs an intro, or actually he doesn't need an intro, but I want to make sure I get everything right. I have Martin Armstrong on with me today. He is having a conference in Orlando, Florida. It's November 21st, the 23rd of this year, the World Economic Conference. It's called the most important annual event in finance that has been described as the alternative to Davos. You can attend in person or virtually. You'll get exclusive forecasts of inflation, capital flows, debt, geopolitics, and insight into his powerful economic model. As Martin says, you don't have to agree with me. Just follow the model. It's never been wrong. You can get your ticket in the show notes here or go to Armstrong Economics and go to the events page. Martin, how are you, my friend?
Oh, pretty good. Just watching the world meltdown, you know.
So, let's talk about that. I had you on, it was in the springtime. It's been about 6 months ago. Where are we at in the meltdowns? What are your models telling us? And also shout out to you. You really changed my opinion on a few things. It's all about capital flows, capital flowing. Talk to me about that, but start with where are we at?
Well, most of what's been going on has been turning on war. And so that comes into play with the whole capital flow issue. And this is why the vast majority, if not 99.9% of the economic models are always wrong. It's primarily because they focus domestically. And the wild card always comes from the outside, not domestic. Like, for example, there's no politician you can look at in history that said, gee, let's make the United States the world financial capital. You know? And that happened largely because of World War I and then World War II. The U.S. was virtually bankrupt in 1896. That's when J.P. Morgan had to lend $100 million to bail out the Treasury. But it was because Europe was blowing itself up that the capital came over here. And that really created the Roaring 20s. So the wild card always comes from the outside. Even like the 87 crash, they had G5 standing up saying they're going to lower the dollar by 40% so they could sell more widgets, and they don't realize that everything in the country is also anything that a foreigner owns would also be devalued. So the Japanese start selling debt, et cetera, you end up with a crash. So, the models that are out there, routinely always are wrong because they are just simply domestic oriented. And after doing this for more than 40 years, I've seen that. I think that the problem becomes that the economists want to sell their trade. And so they're telling politicians, gee, do this and you can manipulate society this way or that way or whatever. And that's where it fails because it doesn't take into consideration the outside. Mm-hmm. And a classic example of that, why we're in trouble at this stage, is that the central banks have been using Keynesian economics. oh, we lower interest rates to stimulate and raise them to, you can just plot it against, you know, the economy. It never works. You know? Yeah, we've done studies on stock market economy versus interest rate. And, you know, it's absurd. When you lower interest rates, that's when you get into a recession. Stock markets go down, not up. When Trump first came to, you know, won in 2016, the Fed started raising interest rates all the time. Stock market went up, but they called it, oh, it was the Trump rally, you know? It's this idea that, oh, they can stimulate or make us do things. It's just false. You had the ECB lower interest rates to negative in 2014. Basically it was almost 10 years of negative rates and still didn't work. The real answer is fairly simple. If you think the stock market's going to double next year, you'll pay 20%. If you don't think it's going to go up 1%, you're not going to borrow at 1%. So it's really interest rates against expectations. If you have no confidence in the future, you're not going to borrow. Simple as that. But, you know, I think it all started with Marx, that this idea that the government can control society, you know, and Keynes kind of, you know, followed along with that. And look, that's the tools of their trade. Listen to me, and we can do this, we can do that, whatever. And it just doesn't work. I mean, right. You know, you get a stock market, you know, will decline, the interest rates decline, and they'll say, well, it was already anticipated, or some other excuse, you know, it was already factored in, they got a million excuses to explain why they're always wrong, but that's pretty much the way.
Yeah. Let me ask you this then. Trump is putting a lot of pressure, or has been putting a lot of pressure, for the Fed to lower rates. What are they seeing? Are we in a recession now? And it seems like what's propping the markets up, correct me if I'm wrong, is there seems to be a lot of money flowing into the U.S. And yeah, talk to me about that. And where is it coming? Is it coming from Europe?
Pretty much. I mean, most of our big institutional clients in Europe, I mean, I've been having them move money largely because Europe's not trustworthy. And they're in serious trouble economically. And you can look on our site. I published, I think, yesterday, you know, two charts that compare the GDP growth of the U.S. and the EU. I mean, the EU growth rate is a tiny fraction of the United States. And that's what brought communism down. This whole idea of equality, et cetera. It doesn't work. It suppresses human nature. All right. You're not allowed to think out of the box. You're not allowed to create something because, oh my God, you might make more money than the guy next to you. You know, and that's why communism failed. This idea of equality. Okay, fine. You're next in line. Here's the broom. You go sweep the floor now. You know, it just abandoned individualism. And that's what Europe has done. And that's why they're failing. Yeah. So, I mean, at this stage in the game, it's the capital's been coming here. You've had Ursula come out even hinting that they can take unused assets, private assets, to use to fund the war. You just had Spain come out and said you can't take more than 3,000 euros out of your account without permission from the government.
Right.
They routinely cancel their currencies. The U.S. has never done that. And they do that largely to, let's say you had $500,000 in cash and you put in your safety deposit box. Well, they cancel it. Now it forces you to come out with that. It's either all go on or you go over and say, okay, give me the new ones. And they go, oh, where'd you get this? Did you pay taxes? Mm-hmm. Whereas here you can get a $10 bill from 1861 and it's still legal tender. We've never canceled our currency. And that is also probably the reason why the dollar is the reserve currency. About 70% of the actual paper dollars are outside the country. Because people basically know that they can trust that, but they can't trust the euro. Even British pounds, they cancel them. So Trump is entertaining issuing $500 bill, which will only increase that even more. You can look up, the New York Magazine. It was front page. They called it the money plane. They're shipping skids $100 bills to Russia. Like I said, 70% of the actual money is outside the country. That's also confused a lot of people because you had, in theory, the money supply increasing and there wasn't inflation. And so then they came up with, the new monetary, theory. They didn't realize is that the dollars are being absorbed worldwide, not domestically. So again, that's part of this whole problem of understanding the world economy internationally versus domestic. We have to, open our eyes a little bit more than the academics do.
Yeah. So do you see that still the case, or that's still going to be the case for the foreseeable future, money flowing here to the U.S. because it's interest rate driven, because they're getting a better return over here?
To some degree on the interest rate, but it's not really just that. It's that when you have Europe beating the war drums over there all the time, that's what sent the money here for World War I and World War II.
Mm-hmm.
If you got tanks running down the street, blowing up banks, you're not going to leave your money there.
Right.
But it's not just physical cash. Most of your rare coins, rare stamps, rare art all ended up here in the United States. Gradually then began to move back in the 60s. But it came here for a safe haven.
Yeah. And I guess my question is, do you see that changing much? And I know there's a lot of drum beating up the BRICS being in competition with us and all that sort of thing. Yeah. Do you see the money flow stopping, or do you see the BRICS even as a viable alternative going money flowing to the BRIC countries?
No, not really. They don't have the rule of law. And look, Brazil is one of the worst debt situations of any country around. China, Russia. These are not places where you can park money and feel secure that you're going to get it back.
Mm-hmm.
The whole BRICS has, you have people that have distorted the reason for it. It's the dollar, de-dollarization, all this stuff. Look, it was geopolitical. When the Biden administration put the sanctions on Russia, removed them from SWIFT, that sent up a red flag. And then you have Blinken, a complete crazy neocon, in my opinion, threatened China that if you help Russia, we'll do the same to you. And so then they start dumping U.S. debt. Why? Because threatening them with war.
Mm-hmm.
You've had a war with China, and they're not going to pay the debt.
Right.
You know, they default on it. You know, you're going to say if they had owned 10% of the U.S. national debt. Okay, so fine. Our interest expenditures were $1 trillion. So $100 billion goes to them, and then they're going to say, oh, they're going to use that to buy missiles to shoot us. You know, they're not going to pay. So that's really what the BRICS became. It was countries that realized that they're tired of being intimidated by the United States and dictated to. And really what makes the dollar the reserve currency. All right. And forget all the politics and the rhetoric, whatever. The U.S. consumer is 25% of the entire world. You're going to sell your BMWs, your Toyotas here. Mm-hmm. All right. That means you have to price them in dollars. So no matter what you want, you can't sell it in lira. You can't sell it in yen or you know, whatever. It's got to be in dollars. So that's really what made the United States the financial capital.
Got it.
And like I said, there was no politician that said, let's come up with a scheme to do this. They're not that smart. Trust me.
So I mentioned to you offline, I just had Dave Cullum on, and he said the BRICS is more about trading and relationships as opposed to currency. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, they are pretty much, like I said, they were threat.
Mm-hmm.
So you either do what I say or this is what I'll do to you.
Right.
So the only defense against that is to create another a clearing system where they can't be interfered with in that way. Have their money frozen or whatever. I mean, look at, you know, at Russia. They froze, Switzerland froze $8 billion of people that just knew Putin. Right. You know, not even government money. You know, it's, you know, this is against international law. I mean, it. When you start doing stuff like that, I'm sorry, you can't trust them.
Yeah.
And if, you know, if I'm on that side, Russian, Chinese, would I give them another dollar? No way.
Right. Excuse me. So, really then, I'm going back to my last talk with you. Are your models still pointing at a debt? Because you just mentioned debt. Are your models going back to a debt deflationary time, if you would, in the next couple of years? Or where are we at with that?
Yeah, look, the real big problem tends to be Europe and Japan. All right. Mm-hmm. Europe, you know, like I said, their economic growth is just a tiny fraction of the United States because you look at Germany, it's 25% of the EU.
Right.
And there's only two countries in the world right now that are actually shrinking in size, their economies, and that's Japan and Germany. Germany, you know, what they did was first you had the COVID nonsense, then you had the migrant crisis, then you put, you know, climate change, then you put sanctions on Russia. Each step basically wiped out small businesses left and right. You saw a big protest with, you know, Volkswagen. Oh, you can't produce gasoline cars. You're going to have to move to electric. You know, all this crazy stuff. I mean, I had, you know, I was in Europe. I had a meeting in Berlin, and I had another one right after that in Rome. Mm-hmm. And I was completely shocked. two major capitals, and I could not get a direct flight to get there in time. I had to hire a private jet. I've never had to do that. But what they've done is, oh, for climate change, they reduced all these flights. They want you, you know, it's just completely nuts. I couldn't believe it. I mean, between Berlin and Rome, and I couldn't get a direct flight.
An 8-hour drive is my guess.
it was just like, I never anticipated that. I ended up having to get a private jet to make the next meeting. I mean, that's never happened to me in 40 years.
Yeah. So what's going to happen that if money's flowing out of Europe, what's going to happen to Europe here? What do you see what do you see happening?
Well, the EU will break up. There's no question about that. Look, when they were forming it, they came to me. I sat down with them in 98, said, okay, fine. This is how we created currency. Pretty much everything that they told the public was just a lie. It was, the German Chancellor Kohl, knew that if he allowed the German people to vote to join the euro, he admitted that he acted like a dictator and he would have lost 7-3. And without Germany, the EU couldn't get off the ground. So he took Germany in basically unilaterally. The German people were never allowed to vote. You can look on our old site. I was dealing with the Bundesbank back then, and they were pissed off at him, and they were giving us all the notes, everything. I couldn't say back then, what the source was, but that's where it was all coming from. I met with him. I said, look, this is how we create it. You got to consolidate the debt or you'll never compete with the dollar. And he would not allow. Kohl said he'll go in, but you can't consolidate the debt because the Germans would think they were bailing out Greece or something.
Right.
And I was told in 98, okay, fine, we understand what you're saying. Because as a trader, it was obvious. I mean, all you were going to do was transfer the volatility between currencies to the bond market. The same thing in the U.S. I said, we got fine a single currency, but you got 50 states and everybody pays different rates according to their credit rating. I said, that's what's going to happen here. Mm-hmm. And they knew what I was telling them was correct. And I was told, look, we just have to get the euro in. We'll worry about the debt later. That was in 1998.
Okay? It sounds like the U.S.
and they haven't done anything. So this is what's tearing Europe apart. You look at all the spreads between the bonds, if they were bearer, Italy, they buy the bonds out of Germany, short the Italian, whatever. Now, because of war, you got Merz, pushing through deficit spending in Germany, abandoning, everything that they were known for, all for war. And so the clock is ticking, basically. They don't have the economy. It's shrinking on top of this. This is why they need war.
Yeah.
You have a choice. If you don't go to war, the people are going to wake up and realize that their pensions are gone, everything, and they're going to come storming the parliaments with their pitchfork. When a country gets in trouble, they need an external enemy.
Yeah.
When gasoline went Biden put on the sanctions against Russia and the gasoline prices went up. You know, what did he say? Oh, it's Putin's inflation.
Right.
You know, I'm sorry, you did it, not Putin, you know.
Right.
But, you know, that's what they always do.
Yeah. Well, what is the EU, if the EU breaks up, what does that look like? Does Germany go, what does Germany do, really? Because that's really the driver. And what does France do? Those are the two biggest drivers, correct me if I'm wrong, of Europe.
You also have serious problems because of the migration crisis there.
Right.
That's different than what we have in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
There, it's more of an ethnic cultural difference. Whereas most of them have come in or from the Middle East, and they're not assimilating. They're bringing their own culture there. So in Sweden, you have areas where they have signs up Shira law here. You know, police won't even go in those some areas. So it's you know, the migration into the United States, they came here to be free, to be part of something. That's not what's taking place in Europe. So, you know, all their ideas have failed. But, you know, and you're more likely to see rising civil unrest throughout most of the major cities in Europe, particularly because the politicians thought letting these people in, they would be able to draft them and send them into the military to go fight Russians. And I don't think they're going to find that's going to be too helpful. You know, our staff in Germany has already said, one that had a friend who was 60 years old and was told to report for duty.
Wow.
So, I mean, look, you got, you know, Trump not really a politician. And what I mean by that is, as you know, I've known many heads of state over the years. I did go to Mar-a-Lago for dinner when he was president the first time, back in March of 2020. And that's when he said that he wanted to take the troops out of Afghanistan, but it was the reason. He said that he didn't want, he was tired of writing letters to their families to say your son died for God and country. And he said, what are we doing there? They've been fighting over borders for 1,000 years. What difference are we going to make? Whereas all of our traditional politicians, they're told, don't think about that. That's just collateral damage. We have to beat them as if it's like some, you know, football game. Don't look at the casualties. There's always casualties, you know. Where Trump did impress me is that he actually looked at the people rather than the objective. But I guess he didn't also see any strategic value to the objective in the first place. So maybe that was part of the difference. And I've spoken with RFK. He too was against the war. So I knew where their hearts really were. And I would say that they were not traditional politicians. Look, I was good friends with Maggie Thatcher, and she still did the Falklands War. You know, it's just the way it is.
So do you see just a forever war, continuing a forever war then, especially in Europe then, because they have to?
Yeah, look, up to this point, these wars have been endless, and they've been instigated by American neocons. You can look on YouTube, you'll see Robert McNamara before he died. He did an apology on Vietnam. He took us into there. He goes, well, you know, we were wrong. we thought Russia was involved. It was just a civil war.
Okay.
You have also on YouTube General Wesley Clark, who did a speech in 2007. He went to the Pentagon after 9/11. He was told that they were going into Iraq. And he says, oh, you tied Saddam to this? They said, no, just going in. You know, and then they told him they wanted to go take out seven other countries. These people, look, I've been to dinner with a number of them. All I can say is that it defies logic.
Yeah.
I think that they just grew up hating Russians because of Khrushchev, we will bury you, and we'll show you, we'll spread democracy to the world or whatever, which we don't even have. But and when Russia fell, communism collapsed. I was in D.C. back then doing some work on in economics for the Reagan administration. But at that time, Gorbachev said, made a speech, and Reagan went to go meet him. And they told him at that stage in the game, they couldn't call him a communist. They just said, you can never trust the Russian. So it looked like a turn from hatred of communism to, you know, ethnic hatred. And there's no rational reason why we should be at war with Russia. Yeah. You have NATO. I've seen the internal memo, but NATO should have been shut down when the Warsaw Pact fell. That was the whole reason for it. All right. And so to remain relevant, to keep the money going to them, they have to keep the same story. Oh, Putin's going to come in. He's going to take all of Europe. Well, he's been there since 1999.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I don't think he has much time left. All right. I don't think you would have waited to the last 6 months of your life, and it's any time you create an agency, U.S. Department of Education, it doesn't matter. All right. They will fight tooth and nail to stay alive.
Yep.
Why? Because that's their salaries. That's their pension.
Yep.
All right. Yep. NATO is just a retirement home for neocons. That's it. And so they have to keep the same threat, as if it was Khrushchev. We will bury you, which was not economic. That was more of a philosophical, religious type thing, communism is better than capitalism thing. That's the old Marxist, agenda. And he really did believe that. And that's why, after the Cuban Missile Crisis, they staged the coup to get rid of him. Right. And then Brezhnev comes in, and you can watch a movie, I think it's called The Courier. There was a Russian colonel, I believe, and they made a movie out of it. He was giving information about the missiles going to Cuba, and that's how JFK knew about it. And they used this British salesman to be the guy going back and forth and bringing the messages. Because in any country you're looking at, there's always people that are pro and against the MIDI government. Doesn't matter. And he thought Khrushchev was reckless, inviting World War III. And so he stuck his neck out and he got caught and they executed him as a traitor. But that's really what you're looking at. Then they overthrew Khrushchev. So it was just a different it wasn't like I'm going to conquer you to make money like Alexander the Great or something. It was it was more of a philosophical, you know, battle.
So do you think anything's going to happen with this new summit between Trump and Putin that's going to happen? Supposedly it's going to happen in Alaska, or do you think it's already, what do you make of all that?
Our computer has had targeted the week of the 18th at the start of this year. I was shocked that Trump picked the 15th to do this, but I think honestly, the way our model worked is that it builds up in pressure. And so it was coming to a pressure point here in August. And I think that pressure, economically, whatever you want to call, politically, whatever, it forces people to take action at that time. So it's not predicting what, Trump will change his mind on this day or something. It's something that causes him to do so, is the way I look at it. Now, looking at the computer, we're going into World War III for next year. And I think that although Trump has his heart in the right place, the problem is that Europe and NATO and Zelensky, they don't want peace. You know, you had Zelensky coming out and said, there'll be no land for anything, whatever. And then the U.S. says, well, he's really talking about no new land, allowing them to keep what he had. But I mean, from Putin's standpoint, let's be objective here. There was the Minsk agreement. He signed that peace agreement that was to let the Donbass separate, like, and you Czechoslovakia separated, Czech Republic, Slovakia, Yugoslavia broke up. They all break up in that region to ethnic line. Serbia, Croatia, Armenia, and Ukraine should have, the Minsk agreement was the answer. Simple as that. Russians have been there in Crimea and the Donbass for centuries. Khrushchev came from that area, and his successor Brezhnev was born in the Donbass. So, so the Cuban Missile Crisis wasn't Russia, it was Ukraine. Ukraine was also the first country to force the breakup of the EU, of the USSR. And the others ended up following Ukraine. So, Ukraine's always been a hotbed. Our computer was able to forecast that. I stood up in 2011, said, look, the war cycle turns up in 2014. 2013, you can Google it. I even said, look, the computer says it's going to start in Ukraine. People say, gee, how can it do that? It's because so many wars have started there. That's the hot spot.
Yeah.
Even the Black Death came from Crimea. All right. The Tartars came, invaded. They brought the plague from Asia. 15% of the population of Crimea are still Tartars to this day. They didn't leave.
What does World War III look like if we're going into World War III?
Much more of a chaotic type version, not where you have one big group against another. You're looking at, I guess the best way to describe it is whatever the old grudges were between two places, they are all surfacing now. So you've got Thailand, Cambodia, India, Pakistan, Iran, you know, Israel, Ukraine, you know, versus Russians. It's you're seeing the same thing starting in South America and Brazil. I mean, it's after, I mean, yeah, I think the computer monitored everything globally, dispassionately. And I think what I've learned from it is that when everybody's doing well and they're all fat and happy, you don't see war. Turn the economy down, it's like, I lost, and it was that guy's fault.
Yeah.
And it seems to be like that. Like, we gave a handful of jets to Greece. And you can look what they made the front pages. They said, oh, now we can do a sneak attack on Turkey.
Right.
All right. I mean, they're two NATO countries.
Right.
But the hatred between Greece and Turkey go back to Alexander the Great. You know, it's like the Middle East. I mean, you know, you get into these things, there's no resolution to them. We had two employees in Ukraine, one from Kiev and one from Donetsk. The two would never even talk to each other.
Mm-hmm.
If you brought a bottle of Russian vodka to dinner in Kiev, trust me, they would have taken it and smashed it over your head. There's no talking to them.
Right.
You know, I would try to explain, you know, hey, you know, do you really understand the history here? And they don't. It's all propaganda. Oh, with Russians. No, it wasn't Russians. I'm sorry to starve your people. Yes, Stalin was there, but Stalin was also not even Russian. He was from Georgia. Second of all, Kaganovich, who was his right-hand man, was from Kiev. He was Jewish, and I believe, as many others do, that he is the one that, we do know that he's the one that orchestrated the stealing of the food. He killed about 7 million Ukrainians. But most people believe that was retribution because the Ukrainians were killing the Jews. So he thought it was like maybe getting back at him. I don't know. But he was from Kiev. He wasn't from Russia. But hey, you know, Stalin was the head of Russia. So we have to blame Russia. When you look, even back in 1888, you can look at Bismarck when he was chairman or chancellor of Germany.
Mm-hmm.
He predicted accurately, he said, Europe will be engulfed in a major war, and it's going to come from the Balkans.
Mm-hmm.
The hatred in that area is just systemic. I mean, I had to deal with the Yugoslav government before it broke up. I went there for meetings, and they said, oh, you know, they killed 600 of us and threw us in a common grave, and I'm thinking I missed something on the news. I said, oh, my God, really? And I said, when was this? Oh, about 700 years ago. I said, oh, okay, that one, you know?
Yeah.
It just lives on forever and ever. Like we were talking about, you know, Greece versus Turkey. I mean, you're going back to Alexander the Great.
Yeah, right. So if this is hitting next year, then does that continue the money flow coming into the U.S. then?
Probably going to intensify next year. You know, what I've warned for is just look at World War One. As soon as that happened, what did they do? When the first bullet is shot, they shut down all the stock markets, so you couldn't sell anything. And Europe is very controlling. This is why right now you have Trump meeting with Putin in Alaska. They're complaining they're not at the table. Well, why should they be? You know, every time you've been at the table, you lied about everything you ever did anyhow. And I mean, I can tell you that, you know, that fiasco of Zelensky going to the White House, what that was really about, that was only supposed to have been a signing ceremony in Kiev. I had sources there. Boris Johnson hopped on the plane. It was in Kiev 3 days in advance. Told Zelensky, no, you insist that you go to the White House and embarrass Trump. Try and create a scene to force him to continue the money going to Ukraine. Mm-hmm. That's what that was all about. Mm-hmm. I sent off the information that I got and I said, hey, this is going to be like a food fight. And that's what you saw.
Yeah.
He was there to try and embarrass Trump, and it backfired on him. And, you know, I hope he doesn't let him in the meeting with Putin, because it would be only the same thing.
Yeah.
Look, I've got videos of this guy, and you see him on our site before he was president. And standing on stage, making jokes about confiscating assets from Russians and Jews. Most people don't realize he married a Christian. His children are baptized. Before president, he was pretending to be a Christian. Only after becoming president, he said he's suddenly Jewish. Why? Because he was a neo-Nazi against all the... And the neo-Nazis were against the Jews. The same as Soros. Soros pretended he wasn't Jewish to survive, you know, the Nazi regime back then, too. That's what Zelensky did.
Yeah.
I have friends in Israel, and they say, he's no Jew.
Yeah, he's a politician.
Well, I think he basically said that to hide the fact that he was part of the neo-Nazi movement.
Yeah. Yeah. Where does gold play, or does it have a role in all of this mess?
Yes, look. Gold is neutral. All right. And what I mean by that, you know, people are, all the central banks are buying gold. Look, they're not speculators. All right. Why are they buying gold? It's geopolitical. You go into war, all right? And China's been dumping U.S. debt. Because you go into war, they're not going to pay that. All right? So they've been dumping the debt and buying gold, all right? Because gold can't be defaulted on. Simple as that. They're not buying it and saying, oh, geez, it's going to go up $200 next week, so I better buy some. They're not. That's not the issue. The issue is basically just economic stability and neutrality. That's really it. And so, yes, gold will go up as you go into war. It always does.
And
I mean, I was there, you know, in the business back in 1980. And I can tell you, gold went from 100 to 400 between 76 to 79. And the last 6 weeks, it went from 400 to 875. Why? That's when Russia invaded Afghanistan. That was it. And just that last 6 weeks, it doubled. So that's the role of gold. It's neutral. It doesn't depend upon who wins the war one way or the other. So... That's really why, you know, you're looking at that. Look, our computer shows that gold will eventually go to 5,000, but, you know, that's not 5,000 in today's dollars. what would it buy? It may buy the same thing, you know, when it's at 5,000. That's just largely what you're looking at, and it's what had gotten me, you know, paying attention to it, you know, and you know, he said, when I was a teenager, I worked part-time in a gold store. I knew the price of gold was $35. And people back then used to buy the coins. That as long as they were dated before 1947, you could buy that. You couldn't buy gold bullion, but you could buy, you know, Cougarands. You couldn't buy the Cougarands then, but you could buy, you know, Austria-Hungary issued Restrike, always dated in 1908. Mexico, you always did 50 pesos and never changed the date, 1947. So they could sell them to Americans. So I knew the price of gold. And I was in high school, and the history professor brought in this movie, The Toast in New York. And it's about, you know, Jim Fisk in the panic of 1869 trying to corner the gold market. And there's this scene in there where he's looking at the ticker tape, and he turns to his girlfriend, Josie. Gold's $162. And I go, what? It's 35 today. You know, how could that be? And it bothered me. I went to the library, looked in the New York Times that date, and that was the price, $162.50.
Well,
so it introduced me to cycle. I then began to realize what they're teaching in school was not correct. I mean, it's not linear. It's cyclical. Sometimes it goes up to a big boom, then it busts, and it goes back and forth. I mean, but that's pretty much it. So, I mean, it was a good movie. You know, you can still watch it, and it's interesting. It's in the panic of 1869.
Excellent. Well, Martin, I've had you on for almost an hour here. Tell me where people can do business with you or find out more about you. Give us your website.
You can go to armstrongeconomics.com. We keep it as an open forum, so you don't have to put in your emails. You don't get, you know, 50, you know, emails from me every day saying you want to buy some swamp land in Florida or something, you know. Now we try to keep it as an open source for, we're amazingly not blocked anywhere. We do have offices in China and Middle East, and we have people attending our conferences from China, Russia, all over the place. So I think everybody realizes it's the computer. We're not fooling around saying, oh, you know, page three, by the way, overthrow your government or something, you know?
All right. And you're having a conference here in Florida here in November.
Yeah. I mean, next year, I think we might end up doing it in Mexico because it's so more people can attend it. But now they're you know, we have more people attending, you know, virtually. So like some 37 countries, they set up sites there to view it. So it's interesting, but I miss the old days of when we would have about 3,000 people in the audience, you know, from all over the world.
Yeah, face to face. Got it. Well, Martin, I'll put all of this in the show notes, both on the YouTube channel, Apple, and Spotify. I want to thank you so much for your thoughts, and I'd love to have you on again really soon.
Yeah, no problem. I'm sure it might be sooner than later, the way the world's going, but.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.